name is Dr. Ethel Tungohun. I'm a writer, a researcher, an associate professor of politics, and an activist. This is Academic Antis. It has been over a month since the Hamas attacks in Israel and since the Israeli government's bombing campaign in Gaza. Since then, and at the time of recording this podcast, the Israeli government has killed 11,000 Palestinians, a staggering number on top of the 1,200 people who were killed in the Hamas attacks on October 7. The Israeli government's bombings have also led to the deaths of countless doctors, journalists, UN workers, and migrant workers. The destruction is staggering. The Israeli government has bombed hospitals and refugee camps. There is no escape. Across the world, we've seen demonstrations calling for a ceasefire and calling attention to what many experts are calling an ongoing genocide. I had the opportunity to attend marches here in Toronto. They have been passionate and peaceful. They've been attended by an incredibly diverse group of people, from Palestinians themselves to those who march in solidarity, like artists, trans and queer activists, union members, and large contingents of Jewish people who refuse to allow the Israeli government to justify the bombings in their name. The protests, which include these demonstrations, as well as those participating in teach-ins and forums, and those writing and circulating letters of support for Palestine, have been subjected to reprisal. People who have been part of these protests have been doxxed, sanctioned, fired, and labeled anti-Semitic. Columbia University in New York, for example, recently suspended campus chapters of Jewish Voices for Peace and Students for Justice in Palestine. The Massachusetts Institute for Technology barred pro-Palestine organizing from taking place on campus. My own workplace has demanded that the student unions that wrote letters in support of Palestine apologize and retract these statements and confirm that they, quote, do not support discrimination, end quote. Administration have also called for these student leaders to resign. Faculty members, too, have borne the brunt of institutional reprisal. People in my immediate circles have been reprimanded by administration, have had their names listed on hit lists accusing them of supporting terrorism, and have faced threats of contract non-renewals because of their support for Palestine. This has happened even in cases where some of my colleagues' calls are not even particularly controversial. They are merely calling for a ceasefire and respect for the Geneva Convention. In this episode, we're going to talk about academic freedom and how the language of anti-racism and equity, diversity, and inclusion are being warped and weaponized to achieve aims that are quite the opposite. We're going to talk first to my good friend, Dr. Rachel Brown, who discusses her research on Israel and Palestine and her journey into becoming an activist with Jewish Voices for Peace. Then we're going to talk to Dr. David McNally, who holds the Cullen Distinguished Professorship of History and Business at the University of Houston, and who's been an activist since the Vietnam era. David will help contextualize the assaults on academic freedom that academics are experiencing now. Have a listen. I am so honored to have my friend, Dr. Rachel Brown, here with me today. Rachel and I have known each other for, gosh, a decade? No, I don't know. We were young once. Now we're not so young. Rachel is an activist, a researcher, and a friend, and I'll have Rachel introduce herself.
Thank you so much, Ethel. I'm so excited to be here. I'm a big fan of your podcast, and I like sharing it with people, so it's really cool to be on the other side of the microphone. As you said, I'm Rachel Brown, and I'm a researcher and a teacher and a writer in St. Louis. And I write and think a lot about Israeli settler colonialism and issues of labor and care. And I'm really happy to be here today.
Thank you for sharing space with us. So you're a researcher who's done a lot of work in the region, in Israel, Palestine. You've traveled there. You've formed communities there. And you have a forthcoming book, Unsettled Laborers, Migrant Caregivers in Israel, Palestine. And you've also written extensively about Israel as a settler colonial state. Can you talk a little bit about your research, especially as it pertains to the Israeli state's ongoing bombing and siege of Gaza?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for the question. So my book, Unsettled Laborers, looks at this connection between care and migrant labor and ongoing settler colonialism in Israel. And the reason I really wanted to write this is because often issues of migrant labor in Israel, and I'm talking about migrants from Eastern Europe and South and Southeast Asia, are talked about as a separate and apolitical issue that's really disconnected from ongoing Israeli practices of dispossession of Palestinian land and ethnic cleansing and the genocide that we're seeing right now. Or it's treated as an effect of racism alone, which obviously it is, but it's also really connected to this settler colonial economy and this project of justifying exclusive Jewish-Israeli domination over land. And so I really wanted to draw out that connection. And it looks specifically, my book, at elder care in Palestine, which is done primarily by migrant workers, and their presence in the labor market, and in more broadly, the labor market. They started coming after the Intifada, which was when a lot of Palestinians were relegated to the West Bank and could not come into Israel because they were deemed by the Israeli state as too, quote unquote, dangerous. And so really, I think what's important here is right now what we're seeing with this indiscriminate bombing in Gaza is the latest iteration of settler colonial practices that are really fundamentally about investing in the lives and the health and the access to resources required for survival for some over others. And we could think about that as investments in care for some over others on a collective level. Whether that's the disproportionate investment in medical resources, food, land to cultivate a living for Jewish Israelis, and the deprivation of the same for Palestinians. These are the precise things that are deliberately targeted by the Israeli state to be taken away from Palestinians, most recently through the bombing of hospitals. Meanwhile, so much is invested in the care of Jewish Israeli individuals and as a collective body. And this work is often outsourced to migrants who have to contest with state racism, contest with, you know, the paranoid violence against non-Jews, form their own networks of resistance and community care. And so I really wanted to pull that out. And the other thing I'll say is many people have seen in the news that the only victims of this violence have not just been, especially the October 7th violence by Hamas, has not just been Jewish Israelis, right? There were Bedouin, there were Arab Israelis, Palestinian citizens of Israel. And there also was Thai, Nepalese, and Filipino workers. And so I think what that really shows is that the brunt of state violence really falls upon those who are not represented by the state at all and who are temporary workers. And I think that's a really important piece of this as well.
And I think that's one thing that I think has been missing in a lot of the crude depictions of the ongoing bombings in Gaza. I mean, I feel like it's being depicted as, oh, well, you know, at least in Canada, and I'm sure in the US as well, oh, it's too complicated. It's like, you know, a Jewish Muslim thing, right? And people just kind of like, I don't know, shy away from talking about it. But as you point out, it's not, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. It's a political issue. It's an anti-colonial issue. And I think, and this is something I can elaborate more on later if you'd like, but right now, Jews in the U.S. are being called to speak out against the genocide. And I think that's by Palestinian organizers, and that's super, super important. And I think as American Jews, and I'm referring to myself here, we have to be careful not to feed into this narrative in other times and spaces in the movement where the assumption is that a Jew needs to authorize every conversation in what's fundamentally an anti-colonial struggle. And so I think that's a really important piece as well.
Okay, that's making me think a lot. Can you speak a little bit more on that?
Yeah, just, you know, I think all of it is strategy. And right now, because the term anti-Semitism is being leveraged to stifle legitimate critiques of the Israeli state, it's important that Jews say, I don't think this is anti-Semitic, right? I'm doing a legitimate critique of a state, just like we're allowed to do, of anybody's allowed to do of any state. And so it is important to leverage our voices as Jews in this moment, especially considering what Palestinian-led organizing is asking for in the calls for a ceasefire, right? And we've seen really powerful examples of that with Jewish Voice for Peace organizing, you know, across the country. And at the same time, the idea that this, as you said, is an obscure religious conflict where you need to be Jewish or Muslim to get involved, I think, is another way of inadvertently or not stifling debate and the ability of ordinary tax-paying citizens whose tax money is going to funding this genocide and this ongoing 75-year occupation from making those critiques. This idea that you need a PhD in Middle East studies, this idea that you need to have some personal connection. And one thing I think is really important is that, you know, if you're in the heart of empire in the US or in other ways in Canada, right, anybody has the ability to critique what our government is doing and what our tax money is doing. And as humans, when we look at these images, it's very hard to not be against what's going on and to say that the valuing of Jewish lives lost by Hamas is not tantamount to the valuing of the 11,000 people that have now been murdered in Gaza.
I think those are really important points to highlight. And I think one thing that's really inspiring about some of the activism I'm witnessing in Canada and also in the US is that people are drawing linkages between empires, right? And so I'm seeing activists storming into different members of parliament offices, activists actually trying to bar the shipment of arms to Israel. So drawing these linkages, I think, are so crucial that it's not just this, like, you know, conflict that we don't have a stake in. Actually, our governments, you know, in Canada, in the US, are complicit in the ongoing genocide, and we have to kind of take ownership of that and make demands. So.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, one thing that I love about your work and the work of people like Joy Sales and others is that it really draws that linkage between thinking about labor outsourcing and historical forms of colonialism and neocolonialism and ongoing forms of settler colonialism. So I think about the work of Migrante International in the Philippines that has always drawn those linkages when they talk about Israel between Palestinian liberation and the colonial forms of labor export that, you know, create a thing called a migrant sending state and a migrant receiving state to begin with. And those linkages are just so, so important right now, especially when we're thinking about who gets killed in this violence and who doesn't have a voice, you know, represented by the state in that violence as well.
100%. So you mentioned that you are part of Jewish Voices for Peace. For our listeners who don't know about this organization, what are their demands and how did you first get involved?
So firstly, I should say that, you know, I've been involved with a couple different JVP chapters. I'm not a spokesperson for them. So this is really me talking about my own personal involvement.
Yeah.
But for me, JVP as an anti-Zionist organization is the one that's most closely aligned with my political views and my own religious practice as a Jew. And I think for me, you know, really, I was raised like many American Jews. Now, nothing, no special story here, unfortunately, but with a very Zionist narrative and white Zionist Jewish narrative. And I went to college and got exposed to activism and Edward Said and started reading a lot more broadly about imperialism and the Ottoman Empire and the British presence in Mandate Palestine, and was pretty angry and baffled that the propaganda machine had allowed me to. I was always skeptical, and I'm not from a particularly Zionist family. They're kind of apolitical with respect to Israel, and I would say now not Zionist. But I think that's all to say this really led me into campus activism in the early 2000s. And since then, I've been on and off in various forms of anti-occupation activism. And then the first time I got explicitly involved with JVP was when I was in Western Massachusetts. And we mostly were doing legislative advocacy, fighting criminalization of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, and, you know, trying to show why this was not a crime and why this should not be criminalized. And then when I moved to St. Louis, I became involved with the St. Louis Jewish Voice for Peace chapter, which at that time, pre-pandemic, was really focusing on organizing around and against the Anti-Defamation League, which is an organization that claims to speak for Jews and claims to tout the fight against or champion the fight against anti-Semitism. Actually, they've been very involved in anti-communist surveillance involved with COINTELPRO, surveillance against South African apartheid movement. And so we did a lot of work around that. And presently, with a couple others, we're really trying to think about ways of revamping our chapter in support of ongoing Palestinian organizing. So that's where we are right now. But in terms of, you know, JVP Nationals' demands, as I understand them, the first and foremost is a ceasefire in Gaza. Stop the genocide, stop the mass killing of innocent civilians. And also stop it in our name. Stop the instrumentalizing of the tragic killing of Jewish Israeli citizens as justification for killing 11,000 people. And so whether that looks like getting in the streets, calling senators and reps or the White House, drawing connections between the war economy and places like Boeing, right, and the bombs that are manufactured and shipped to Israel. This is all part of that bigger movement. And then the other thing I would say is for JVP, even though the focus at this exact moment is ceasefire, it's part of a broader attempt to call for an end to the 75-year occupation of Palestine, the presence of Israel as a settler colonial state in the region, and to ensure true safety, not by exceptionalizing violence against Jews, but really through solidarity, right? Through multiracial, cross-class, multi-faith coalition building that sees anti-Semitism as one form of white supremacy, just like Islamophobia is, just like anti-Blackness is, and how all of these intersect with the war economy.
Absolutely. And seeing all of these linkages is so crucial to ensure our collective liberation. If I may, because I'm kind of, I mean, I feel like we've had a lot of chats, but I've never actually probed this part of your journey before. You know, you started reading about this, started encountering Saeed, started meeting activist communities in college. Prior to that, it was just like, oh, it's taken as given that, of course, you know, birthright, you know, tourists are just something people do, right? Like, was there never some, like, you said that you were kind of puzzled by this and you were kind of uncomfortable, but you never really, like, thought about it, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think for so many people, and especially, you know, people in white suburbs growing up where the world is kind of made for you and you're not made to question it very often, I think that there were moments where I was like, huh, this is strange. These people seem to be super obsessed with this place called Israel. But, you know, because I wasn't from a family that went to Israel or that, you know, was like unquestioningly Zionist, it wasn't as much part of my fabric, but it was absolutely part of my Hebrew school education. And whether that was at every Shabbat service doing fundraising to raise money for Israel or, is, you know, Jews to immigrate to Israel, or, you know, my birth certificate from my grandparents says that a tree was planted in my name in Israel, which is like a very one-to-one settler, part of the settler project of what Patrick Wolf calls destroying to replace, right? And so there are so many aspects of my Jewish upbringing that are just laden with American Zionism. And like so many of us, I felt like something was off with that, but I didn't have the language to articulate it. I didn't know what imperialism was. I didn't know, you know, how this was connected to kind of proxy projects of these broader colonial powers like Britain and the US until much, much later. And it was just really a kind of slow unlearning, I would say. And that really speaks to the power of this narrative and the need to teach different ones to Jews growing up now, and also to reclaim Judaism. It does not have to be and should not be defined by the Israeli state, which does not speak for us and, in fact, is anathema to Jewish values. And there's a long, rich history of anti-Zionist organizing that precedes the modern state of Israel. There's no question we have a cultural and religious connection to the land, but to turn that through laws, policies, and colonial practices into a nationalist, exclusionary political project fundamentally based upon dispossession of Palestinians is a very different thing.
And I think, you know, what you're talking about, this journey that you've been on. What's fascinating is witnessing, at least through social media, a lot of folks from Jewish Voices for Peace, but also not, right? Being like, you know what, you know, it's time for us to unlearn some of the entitlement that we felt we had, right? And I think I emailed you about this. I was, you know, marching in support of the ceasefire, marching in support of Palestine last week. And I was heartened by seeing a huge contingent of marches with the huge banner Jews for Palestine. And I thought that was really cool. And so we've talked a bit about this already, but maybe just to kind of talk about it a little bit further, a lot of politicians, including Joe Biden.
Oh yeah. Our favorite septuagenarian. I'm being sarcastic for anyone listening.
No, I'm just cackling here because really, you know, Genocide Joe, he's been called, right? And even our so-called feminist prime minister here in Canada, there seems to be a reticence to like directly criticize the Israeli state and, you know, either directly through statements equating any critique of Israel with anti-Semitism. And your response to this would be, that's not true. The state's not the people. Is there anything else you would like to say to that?
Yeah, just that I think a lot of these critiques are incredibly sinister attempts at silencing in almost a McCarthyite fashion, you know, critiques of Israel. And that also most Zionists are not Jewish. They're Christian Zionist. And I think that's a really... in the U.S., and I think that's a really important piece.
Wait, what? What do you mean? Really?
Well, just that, yeah, Zionism, I mean, it may also be the case that in a certain generation, most Jews are Zionist in the U.S., but most Zionists in the world are not Jewish, right? They're Christian Zionist. And so that's all to say that there can be these strange bedfellow connections between Zionist Jews and anti-Semitic actors that are Zionist, right? Mm. And I think that's really important. So, for example, a few years ago, Hungary put out these incredibly anti-Semitic billboards about how George Soros is funding protests. And Benjamin Netanyahu, not surprisingly, actually supported them because it supported, in turn, a certain favorable view of Israel. And so there's ways in which you see these strange bedfellow alignments that show, in fact, it's not even always about anti-Semitism when you have Jewish Zionists making these allegations. And certainly it's not about actual anti-Semitism when you have anti-Semites making these allegations for their own strategic benefit. And what that really does is also, in addition to trying to divide and conquer solidarity, it obscures real instances of anti-Semitism that are occurring and actually happen. And the only other thing I would add is just that there's such a huge, rich history of anti-Zionism. When Theodor Herzl, who's considered the father of modern Zionism, quote unquote, first announced that, you know, his idea for a Jewish state, Jews across the world were saying we can't achieve safety and fight anti-Semitism through this project. And there was so much objection that at the turn of the century in 1897, when Herzl had a congress to talk about this, it had to be moved from one city to another. The majority of Reform Jews through the 1930s were opposed to, you know, an exclusively nationalist project in Palestine. There were joint anti-colonial struggles for decades among Sephardic Jews who lived for centuries in Palestine and Palestinians who really saw this as a remnant, this project as a remnant of the same kind of colonialism you see by the British in Iraq. So this is all to say there's a huge, rich history of anti-Zionism, and it's only when we have a certain kind of historical amnesia and a really presentist lens do we miss that. And does Zionism become synonymous with Judaism?
So you mentioned McCarthyism, and I want to kind of pivot a little bit to talk about pro-Palestine activism in workplaces, including but not exclusively in college spaces and in campus. In many spaces, we are witnessing reprisal against faculty members, students, you know, members of the campus community who dare utter Palestine, who dare utter support for Palestine. I myself have heard these stories from friends who I hold near and dear to my heart, who, you know, they talk about Palestine in a class on citizenship, in a class on borders, suddenly find that they're facing sanctions, right? Why are these college spaces, university spaces, campus spaces, such fraught spaces when discussing Palestine?
I think that historically campuses have been really crucial sites of radical political activism, especially around anti-war activity, and also sites of reactionary conservative containment by administrations. And so I think this moment is part of that genealogy, and it's really important in this moment to learn from past activism around Vietnam, South African anti-apartheid movement, civil rights movement, Third World Liberation Front strikes in the UC system, all these forms of activism that push against this form of McCarthyism. But I think also the university is fundamentally supposed to be, if we take them at their own words, they're supposed to be a place of the free exchange of ideas. This is not that, even by their own instrumental use of that language, you know, the First Amendment, liberal marketplace of ideas language. But also there's harassment and doxing and physical harassment, online harassment, rescinding of people's jobs for people speaking out against Israeli apartheid, especially Palestinian students and Muslim students. And so that is not actually protecting students. And I think history always tends to show how these things pan out, what ends up being a commonly understood presentist idea of what constitutes injustice at the moment does not seem like that to some that are rallying against it. And so I think if administrations want to be on the right side of history, they need to do much better.
Absolutely. I think one of the things, and I'm guilty of this too, is we are guilty of presentism. I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, I think we started this conversation before taping being like, well, it's just been so dark. And it is dark. It feels like a heavy moment in history, but also remembering that past struggles have also existed. And so, you know, the arc of history is long, and thinking about, you know, these other campaigns, you know, global movements against war, the movement against South African apartheid, right? Contextualizing it, I think, offers a little bit of hope, I would say.
Yeah, maybe that's Pollyannish of me, but, you know, I like to think about that because so many movements have strategized this before, you know.
As Rachel talked about, what we're experiencing now has a lot of parallels to the kinds of pushback that we've seen historically. I've heard many times that this seems like another 9/11. Others have talked about this as being an era of McCarthyism. We're going to come back to Rachel, but I wanted to unpack that a little bit. And to do so, I spoke to my colleague, Dr. David McNally, who's been active in activist spaces since the Vietnam era. For our listeners, David, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your relationship to the Palestine Solidarity Movement?
My involvement in social justice activism and organizing goes back to being a teenager joining demonstrations in Toronto against the war in Vietnam. So this was as a high school student. And interestingly, I said in a speech to students at York about 20 years ago that solidarity with Palestine has become the global justice issue for their generation that Vietnam and opposition to the Vietnam War was for mine. And so particularly since the intifadas of the beginning in the 1990s, the launch of the global boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, I have tried to be a supporter in every way that I can of Palestine solidarity organizing. While I was in Toronto and at York, this also meant as a member of Faculty for Palestine, which remains a really important network of faculty members who stand up for Palestine solidarity and really try to organize against repression of pro-Palestinian voices on campus. And then I've had the honor of both speaking at Israeli Apartheid Week in Toronto and chairing panels for IAW. So I feel that in a lifetime of work for global justice, Palestine has been particularly in the last 20 or 25 years at the forefront for me. And I would argue it needs to be now for all of us.
Understanding this kind of longer arc of social justice activism that you've been involved with, are you witnessing similar dynamics when it comes to what's going on now, or is it a little bit more amplified? I mean, I think speaking to colleagues who are Palestinian, some of them have said to me, Ethel, honestly, it feels like it's just hotter now. It feels like another 9/11. It feels just, I don't know, it feels more tense. It feels scarier.
I think there is a 9/11 element to this moment. My own view, Ethel, and I'll explain why in a moment, is I don't think it will endure in the same way that post 9/11 moment, you know, really derailed, for instance, the global justice movement, sometimes called the anti-globalization movement, which had erupted onto the streets of Seattle and so many other cities. After 9/11, so many of those movements were just driven into retreat on the grounds that all opposition to Western governments and the U.S. government in particular was terroristic in nature. It was a terrible moment. And I agree that there are similarities right now. And state institutions, universities, major corporations, and so on, they've got a very developed playbook right now in the way in which they isolate individuals and launch just unbelievably vitriolic slander campaigns against them. I think the difference of this moment, and it's one of the reasons that they're so vehement right now, is that there are much larger chunks of the population where the argument coming from Western governments is not getting traction. And this is particularly true among younger people. There's a deep generational divide over Israel and Palestine. You know, people under 40 are way more receptive to the Palestinian cause and to the idea that the Israeli state practices a form of apartheid. This is why they're so focused on university campuses in this moment, because it's where Palestine solidarity is really grounded among a younger generation of obviously activists and organizers, but it's broader than that. There's a sensibility that in support of Palestinian liberation that's much more widespread. So yes, while I think it has its 9/11 moment elements, I think the fact that they're not steamrolling ideologically, particularly among communities of color and younger people, I think there are openings for Palestine solidarity right now, which make it a more contradictory moment than simply a 9/11. But there is that element, and we have to be very careful about protecting people who have distinct vulnerabilities, whether they are of status, precarious employment, or what have you right now, because the forces that are lining up in support of the genocide in Gaza, these are powerful forces, and we need to be very well organized to protect them. Recently at a teach-in here in Houston, when an untenured faculty member from Rice University talked about it, I said, listen, you need to get senior people like me in the front. So that the untenured faculty know they've got not just allies, but people who will stand up and take the hits, because we're institutionally less vulnerable.
Can we talk a little bit about universities as spaces where we're witnessing a lot of reprisal, right? Why have universities become such contested spaces when it comes to Israeli occupation? And why does support for Palestine seem to be equated with anti-Semitism, leading to multiple cases of reprisal, to withdrawn job offers, as in the case of the University of Toronto Law School, retracting a job offer? Like, what's going on here? Can you help contextualize that?
Yes. So I think in the first instance, we need simply to acknowledge the institutional forces in and around the neoliberal university. And what I mean by that is these are institutions that are either hugely reliant on government funding, or if they're private universities, as the majority are here in the US, they are utterly beholden to large donors. And these donors have huge ties in the corporate sector and to all kinds of parapublic organizations, boards of regents of universities and those sorts of things. And so they're hugely susceptible to pressure from on high, be they government bureaucrats, sometimes outrightly heads of state governments or provincial legislatures and that sort of thing, or major corporate benefactors of the sort that went after the students at Harvard, for instance, who put out a pro-Palestinian statement. And, you know, some of these corporate bigwigs were coming out saying, I want every name because these people will never work for me. And that sort of thing. So the universities, between state pressure and high-level mega-corporate pressure, are simply crumbling. And the reality is that all of their ostensible commitments to free speech evaporate 9 times out of 10 when those with institutional weight and power in our society come for them. The other part of the context, which is critical, is that when we look at the governments that are lining up with Israel's genocide in Gaza right now, these are the Euro-American historic governments of Western colonialism. And we really need to underline this. The situation looks very different in a lot of the global South right now, where hundreds of thousands are demonstrating multiple times every week in solidarity with Palestine. But in Britain, they're going after free speech for Palestine. Germany has banned pro-Palestine demonstrations, even when it's Jewish organizations that are doing it. They're being arrested the same way members of Jewish Voices for Peace and Not in Our Name were arrested in the Capitol building in Washington last week. So in France, they have banned pro-Palestine demonstrations. This is, in other words, the classic alignment of Western colonialism, which came together to create the State of Israel in the first instance, who are now waging, using every tactic to wage a war of repression against free speech, free assembly, anything that is devoted to solidarity with Palestine. And were it not for the fact, Ethel, that as I was saying earlier, that we have a much more receptive population overall because of the last 25 years of Palestine solidarity work. If not for that, it would feel like we were entering a decade of McCarthyism. But I think the problem is that decade in the 1950s, there was a real ideological hegemony of the Cold War ideology, and particularly in the United States. I think the fractures in that hegemony are too big for them to be able to steamroll.
You know, I was on campus today, and one thing that I've noticed, there's an atmosphere of, I feel like, tension, but I did see a lot more students wearing the keffiyeh, right? And I was like, interesting. There's like these pockets of dissent, right? That otherwise, you know, you wouldn't witness normally. But I think what I'm witnessing is people are angry that administration is clamping down so hard, even people who otherwise wouldn't be as political, quote unquote, right? A lot of university letters are actually deploying EDI language to justify reprisal, right? Some of the letters that I've seen have said, oh, the reason we're asking student body leaders to retract their statements of support for Palestine is because we have to uphold EDI principles in that we don't want people to feel discriminated against. What do you make of, I don't know, these tactics? Is this part of the playbook that you've witnessed before? I mean, I don't know. It just seems kind of fishy to me that the same equity principles that you and I uphold are now being used against people who are putting out pro-Palestine messages of support.
Yes. And it goes back to the charge of anti-Semitism.
Yep.
Every time we speak out for Palestine. And, you know, I think this has become the fallback simply because nothing else has the least shred of credibility. The idea that you have to displace 1.4 million Palestinians in Gaza, that you need to turn off the water and electricity supply to 2.2 million people, which, by the way, as you well know, Ethel, is a violation of international humanitarian law.
100%.
It's a war crime under the Geneva Conventions.
Yep.
But so the problem is all of the actual empirical evidence of the moment, 42% of all houses in Gaza have been damaged or destroyed by Israeli bombing. What's happening to children? Remember, prior to the bombardment, 22% of Palestinian children never saw their fifth birthday. All of that empirical evidence is so compelling that there is a slaughter going on that constitutes war crimes by all international law, means that they don't actually have factually based responses. And so all really that the pro-Israel camp can do is to charge anti-Semitism. This is why the mobilizations by groups like Jewish Voice for Peace have been so hugely important. The not in our name call, the idea that the authentic Jewish radical tradition is hostile to what the Israeli state does and is doing to Palestinians is really vital for us right now. And I think that it helps us to disarm that charge. Having said that, you're right that the fallback is the claim about people have to feel safe. And therefore, we can now bring in diversity and equity language to do that, to guarantee that safeness. The problem is that, as Angela Davis put it some years ago, university commitments to diversity are not commitments to justice. And we really need to underline this. It is not true that justice means that the Ku Klux Klan has to be allowed to spout its racist hatred of Black people. That is not what diversity and equity mean. And so we have to affirm, no. There are some basic principles of human rights, of social justice, and these are the foundation of all any and all claims to equity. But equity does not mean that the oppressor can continue with impunity to demonize a whole people, for instance, as is being done with the people of Palestine. You know, it's incredible the kinds of statements that are coming out of members of the Knesset right now. The reference to Palestinians as human animals and so on. Those kinds of references are not and ought not to be covered by diversity, equity, and inclusion. Hate towards identifiable groups was never meant to fall under that. So I think the key thing is the Angela Davis insight that any real commitment to diversity and equity is underpinned by justice. And once we insist on that, then those who want to claim their right to speak injustice and to mobilize injustice can be challenged.
Absolutely. And I really like that framing, actually, because as I'm sifting through my emails and sifting through president's responses, I'm like, what? Like, it's just perplexing and bizarre word speak, right? So we had an interview with Jennifer, who's a Palestinian scholar, activist based at UC Santa Cruz. And one thing she said is, listen, I expect backlash from the right wingers, right? Like, of course, you know, like these are, like, of course, like fascist right wingers will be against what we're doing. But I think what kind of guts her and what's harder to take is when otherwise progressive allies, people who would be marching with us in support of trans rights, people who would be marching with us in support of abortion, migrants' rights, all of that stuff, right, are silent when it comes to Palestine. And so what is mobilization and solidarity work looking like for you? Should we try to reach out to our progressive allies, knowing that, you know, the right-wingers, we're not going to reach them anyway, right? What can we do to support Palestinian solidarity as academics?
There's no question that the people who are progressive except for Palestine have tended to just go completely silent about the genocide in Gaza right now. And yes, I think where appropriate, they need to be challenged as to their moral responsibilities to stand up and speak out against genocide. I think that is important. But the critical thing, I believe, is to claim space in every way that we can. We did an emergency teach-in for Gaza here at the University of Houston. We had a visiting Palestinian faculty member from Berkeley. We had our own Palestinian faculty member from my Department of History at the University of Houston. And then we had a colleague from South Africa who had grown up, her parents had had to get her out of the country during the anti-apartheid struggle. We had a colleague from Mexico who spoke up and talked about histories of colonialism in Mexico and in Palestine. We had a colleague from Canada speaking on the panel. And it was really important and moving, particularly for the Arab students in the room, to see people from other parts of the world standing up for Palestine. Because I think right now it's very easy to feel besieged and to feel, because Washington carries a big stick and dominates the media in particular, it's easy to feel like everywhere you turn, all the forces that matter are against you.
Thanks to David for his insights. I now want to return to Rachel to close off this conversation. I asked Rachel, what is at stake in the current moment and why should people care?
I think first and foremost that a Palestinian child is being killed every 10 minutes. Like, we need an immediate ceasefire period. Not as Jews, yes, as Jews, yes, as Americans, yes, as people in the heart of empire, but as humans. You know, you see some of this footage and this indiscriminate bombing and killing, and it's wrong, right? And somehow people know this with, when Jewish Israeli children have been killed, somehow people know this in the Ukraine, and through the dehumanizing of Palestinian life in the media and the erasure of, you know, the Palestinian-led Palestine liberation movement, this gets obscured. And so I think the most immediate thing at stake is ending this genocide. And then I think more broadly, thinking about, for those of us in the U.S. paying taxes, I mean, our country pays $3.8 billion a year to the military in Israel, which is in an aggregate sense is more than any other country since World War II. And so the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights has a really brilliant website detailing where that money could go, whether that's to households with public housing, children receiving free or low cost health care, elementary school teachers. That money could be used in so many ways at home. And so I think beyond what's at stake in the present moment, what else is at stake is that we can't actually achieve safety for anybody in the Middle East or for people at home who live in a police state, like that's the reality, without addressing these linkages between, whether that's arms sales between the U.S. and Israel, whether that's, you know, economic aid to Israel, whether that's political power given to Israel through the U.S.'s viewing it as a kind of a proxy of power in the Middle East. All of these things do not make anybody safer.
100%. I think as you're talking, I'm also thinking a lot of the times, you know, that's also part of kind of the Zionist move to prevent discussion, right? Like, seeing all of these different interconnections, right? And so kind of even step one for listeners is reading the resources. 2 weeks ago, we had Professor Jennifer Mogadam, who's a Palestinian scholar based at UC Santa Cruz, talking about the Palestinian Feminist Collective. They have a resource list. Reading, you know, and informing yourself. And I'll ask you, Rachel, for other resources as well. And tracing the money, seeing these connections, knowing what's at stake, right? Any final words, insights, comments?
Thank you for having me. I mean, it's really an honor to be here and to learn from your work and to get to talk with you as always.
I want to thank Rachel and David for taking the time to speak with me. It was helpful for me to hear from both of them on the differences between anti-Zionist critiques and anti-Semitism, and why charges of the latter are intended to distract and divide us. I've been to several marches now, and contrary to what the right-wing media says, the messages in these marches have been peaceful and, dare I say, even hopeful. Not a single sign or slogan that I've seen and heard have been anti-Semitic. People in these protests have united, seeking a stop to bombings in Gaza and yearning for a more hopeful, more peaceful future for Palestine. When listening to Rachel and to David, and also reflecting on the marches I've attended, I am moved when thinking about the interconnections across various struggles and why we should retain hope that our collective action will lead to our collective liberation. So those of us working within university and college settings should not cede ground. Our universities should continue to be sites for critical thinking and for academic freedom. For those of you who would like to learn more about the issues of academic freedom in universities as it pertains to discussions on Israel and Palestine, please attend a webinar on academic freedom in universities to be held on Tuesday, November 21 from 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. That's Toronto time. We've put the registration link in the show notes. Thank you for listening to Academic Aunties. As we try to survive the weeks ahead, please, please, please remember to take care, be kind to yourselves, and don't be an asshole.